This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. Today, I'm speaking to consultant clinical psychologist Dr. Dania Pillay, and we're going to be discussing the gender bias in autism. And I'm going to be asking the question whether girls and women are going undiagnosed or whether it is underdiagnosed among girls and women. Because you might have heard that autism is more common among boys than girls. A commonly quoted number is a ratio of 4 boys to 1 girl. But is there actually a gender bias that's resulting in girls and women, fewer girls and women being reported with autism spectrum disorder? So I hope to get Dr. Dania to help us break down this question, explore it a little bit more, and to understand where gender biases might be playing a role. How are you today, Dr. Dania?
Well, thank you.
Maybe Dr. Dania, a bit of a refresher to start, so that we are all on the same page. What exactly is autism spectrum disorder? What are its characteristics?
Well, okay. So autism spectrum disorder is a neurodevelopmental disorder which causes difficulties in 3 main areas. So social skills, communication, as well as behavior. While autism can be diagnosed at any age, it's said to be a developmental disorder because symptoms generally appear in the first 3 years of life. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about autism being on a spectrum, right, basically it refers to a wide range of symptoms and level of severity. So what we need to remember is that each person with autism may present very differently, meaning the way this person learns, behaves, thinks, problem solves can range from high functioning mm-hmm. to low functioning. So from highly skilled to perhaps very challenged, you know. So in the same line of thought, a person might with autism might be completely independent in day-to-day living, whereas another person might need full assistance with day-to-day living, you know. So it can be very different.
All right.
And you asked about some of the symptoms, right? So some of the typical symptoms that we often see in, say, for example, in adults is poor eye contact, difficulty talking about their feelings, difficulty socializing, maybe being a bit blunt, not interested in others, not interested in people around them, perhaps having the same routine every day, being a bit rigid about certain things, not understanding certain social rules and cues, mm-hmm. you know. So these kind of little things might be there.
And these characteristics come about because neurologically there's something where they're divergent, I suppose, from the typical.
Yes, that's right. You know, brain activity is different. And again, when we talk about causal factors, there are no known causal factors yet. You know, mm-hmm. there are different factors that might make a child or adult more prone to ASD. So there are environmental, biological, genetic factors that are all known to play a role.
All right. So until recently, many studies have been pointing out that autism affects males around 4 times more than females. Although now there's evidence showing a slightly smaller ratio of 2 or 3 men to 1 woman. Now that's studies. What have you been observing so far in your practice?
In general, I too have seen more boys than girls who are on the spectrum. You know, but we need to question, why is this the case? Is autism really affecting more men or boys than women and girls? I feel there's no real straightforward answer to this. And I mean, research is continually being done to find out more and to see if there really is a link between biological sex, gender roles and autism. But historically, research studies have shown that more males than females have autism.
So historically, this evidence is observational, isn't it? But has there been any work looking into what might be some sort of genetic or biological reason for it?
As I mentioned, I mean, things research on this area is ongoing. But to answer your question, a lot of what we know about autism is based on data that has been derived mainly from boys and men. You know, so that's one of the things that we need to be aware of when we talk about diagnosing people on the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So we are often we are missing out girls and women because their symptoms might look different. You know, because our idea, our perception of what autism looks like has been based on what has been manifested through boys and men.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because they are the ones that where you see more reports of autism.
Yes. And their symptoms might be more prevalent. The way in which they're showing the symptomology might be more obvious. I mean, while there's no clear-cut reason why women are less likely to be affected by autism than men, the research shows that, I mean, there might be some reasons to understand why women are less likely to be diagnosed, you know, like when we talk about the ratio and all that, why are less women being picked up,
mm-hmm.
right? So again, as I mentioned before, a lot of research has focused around male characteristics, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the diagnostic criteria itself seem to be based on what we have seen based on research, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which are all male as well. Again, I'm not saying there isn't a research that has been done with females, but it's less.
Mm-hmm.
It is very, very much less compared to when you look at the big studies and all, a lot of the sample size consists of men and boys.
Right.
And on top of that, this is something that we'll probably talk a bit about later as well, but the signs and the symptoms in females seem to be less evident or less severe, you know? So they kind of slip through the cracks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And women and girls, especially those who are slightly milder on the spectrum, they might be a little better at pretending or blending in, you know, masking their symptoms. So again, they slip through the cracks.
Mm.
So there are a few factors to think about as to why girls, especially girls and women who are not so severe,
mm-hmm.
don't get diagnosed.
Would they have actually vastly different symptoms? You did mention something about how it looks a bit different in girls and women, slightly different symptoms.
Well, when we talk about symptoms in women, okay, so some of the symptoms in both, I mean, okay, so three main things that we can think about when we talk about how it might be different is boys may have very obvious repetitive behaviors or restrictive interests.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But with girls, they might be a lot more socially appropriate. So with boys, perhaps they might have this fixation with numbers or the solar system or dinosaurs or train timetables or, you know, things like that.
Okay.
Whereas girls, or I mean, later on we can talk about women as well, but their interests might be a little bit more socially appropriate. So being interested in unicorns or dolls or, you know, something like that. However, we also have to think about the intensity in which this fixation is. But the fact is, a little girl liking unicorns isn't something odd, right? So mm-hmm. parents, teachers were like, oh yeah, it's just a phase. You know, mm-hmm. yeah, it's pretty common, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, when we talk about girls on the spectrum, research has also shown that they have a lot more social motivation compared to boys and men. You know, so they actually want to be involved socially. There might be an interest to have friendships. They want to have friendships, you know,
mm-hmm.
and empathy might be a bit better as well. So their communication, their social skills, their friendships might be at least one level up compared to with their male counterparts, you know. So
mm-hmm.
that's why when you compare a boy with autism versus compared with a girl with autism, the differences might be quite stark, especially if they're both on the mild end, you know. So
mm-hmm.
a girl with autism might present like a typical girl, just with slight awkwardness, you know. So she might get labeled as, oh yeah, she's just a bit of an oddball, she's a bit reserved,
mm.
that's about it, you know. And so that might be some of the difficulties that we might see when it comes to girls. And also girls tend to internalize their emotions, you know, whereas boys might show non-compliant behavior. They might be a little bit more disruptive in class. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm talking about like a student, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas girls might actually come off as being the ideal student.
Quiet.
You know, they're quiet, mm-hmm. reserved, follows instructions, academically all okay. She has a select few friends. So again, on the surface, why would a teacher refer this child? You know, especially in the early years, you know, I myself have seen quite a few girls where towards the teenagers, you know, tween and teenagers, things that the gap starts to widen a little bit, you know, because the expectations and demands change, right? So at that stage, things get a little bit more apparent. But in the younger years, yeah, she seems to be okay. You know, shy, quiet, intelligent, you know, not a student that you would typically send for an evaluation.
So if from the teenage years, perhaps, is then when the differences become more stark, what would a girl be going through at that point, and what would the challenges that she would be facing?
Well, again, I feel like with girls, you know, the way when we talk about gender roles and all, right, the way a girl plays might be different from the way a boy plays, right? So throughout, like, say, primary years, perhaps, she might have been guided by her male female friends, you know, just how to play, this and that. But once she reaches a certain age, so like these teenagers and all, other things start to happen. These teenage girls grow up and cliques form, you know, subtle non-verbal language, you know, like rolling of eyes, shrugging, you know, so she might not be able to pick up on all this. And again, so the social imitation, you know, so perhaps there are a lot of girls who have adjusted through their early years just by observing and copying what others are doing, because they know the importance of this being socially aware, right? So they might not actually fully understand it, but they're just following.
Would we see teenage girls on the spectrum then starting to experience more isolation, or perhaps, you know, mental health issues? You know, what would they be struggling with?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I myself have seen quite a few teenage girls who have been referred for different things, you know, just exactly like what you said, you know, being anxious, low mood, no motivation to study, friendship difficulties, right? Things like that. However, like upon further examination, I mean, the longer time that I'm spending with the child, it becomes a little bit more obvious that there could be underlying, that autism might be an underlying factor. You know, and it might not be something obvious to, like, to the untrained eye, you know, because it is quite tricky. It is quite confusing, because this child, I mean, this teenage girl, has just adjusted all the way. She's blended in all the way. And at this stage, it might be even confusing for the parents, or some parents might even say, like, yeah, I always thought something was a little different. And I've seen families who have said, oh, we actually got our child tested, you know, when she was 6 or 7 or 8 and or even younger, but she never truly fulfilled the criteria, like ticked all the boxes, you know. But yeah, so, you know, she coped, but now she's really struggling, you know. So friendships, academics, I mean, and again, when we talk about going to school and all, it's not something as simple as just learning, you know. It's not just academics. There's so many levels of social demands and social intricacies that take place that can be very stressful.
And it's a big part of how you form your identity, and really the way you see yourself and in adulthood. That's what the adolescence years are about. All of us struggle, so I can't imagine somebody who is neurodivergent, you know, with so many more challenges. Let's go for a quick break, Dr. Dania, and when we come back, I'd just like to get you to explain a little bit more about that masking that you mentioned. I'm sure you've already been touching on it, but just to clarify that term, and then we'll go into, you know, trying to figure out how families can cope then if the diagnostic criteria isn't helpful at this point. You know, what can families do to maybe keep pushing to find out more if it's their daughter who's affected? I'm speaking to consultant clinical psychologist Dr. Dania Pillay, and we are discussing the gender bias in autism. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to the show with me, T. Xiaoyi. It's our Health and Living segment, and I'm speaking to consultant clinical psychologist Dr. Danya Pillay. We're discussing the gender bias in autism and how girls and women tend to be underdiagnosed for several reasons. Now, autism spectrum disorder is a neurodevelopmental disorder with certain characteristics that identify that a person learns, behaves things differently, and they can range from being high functioning to low functioning. Now, the issue that I've been discussing with Dr. Danya is how girls and women tend to present differently with the characteristics and symptoms of autism, and that very often they don't meet the diagnostic criteria if they are screened for autism spectrum disorder. Dr. Danya, you did bring that up, that some parents have even, said that they suspected something might, that there might be a reason to get their daughter tested for autism, and yet she didn't fulfill the diagnostic criteria. So in a situation like this, Dr. Danya, that's going to be very difficult, isn't it? Observing with your own eyes, you can tell that a child is not neurotypical, and yet the test says she is. What would parents be doing in a situation like this, and how can we help them to get through this?
Yeah, I mean, it can be very challenging, because sometimes families just want an answer, because it gives us sort of guide, you know, okay, this is what it is, this is what we need to do, this is how I can explain it to the school, this is what her teachers can help with, you know, mm-hmm. how do we help my child proceed, what are the next steps. But in situations like I mentioned before, whereby say the child doesn't fulfill the criteria, but it's clear that she has some difficulties in social communication, she has some difficulties with friendships, you know, she has difficulties in these areas, in those situations, then we look at solutions to the presenting problem. You know, fine, you know, that the diagnostic criteria isn't quite helping us here, but let's look at the symptoms. And if these are the difficulties, we work with what we can do. So in situations like this, I would tell parents, we still work with it. You know, mm-hmm. if the child needs to attend therapy, if these are the things that we need to do, we still proceed, mm-hmm. regardless of the diagnosis. Because the foundations, the early stages are so important. You know, like you mentioned before, the adolescent stage is, it's setting the stage for how we are in adulthood as well. Mm-hmm. You know, what are our coping mechanisms, how we see the world, how we see ourselves. So regardless of the diagnosis, if a child shows that, I mean, there are difficulties, we would still address it.
And earlier, Dr. Danya, you brought up the term masking, or I've also heard that women and girls could also camouflage their autism. Now, you have touched on it a little bit, how girls show more social motivation. But can you just, clarify that term masking, examples of what they might be doing, and what happens if they continue to mask through teenage years, somehow they manage to get through it right into adulthood?
Okay, so masking basically means pretending, blending in. You know, a more academic term would be like using the word compensatory strategies or camouflaging strategies, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a way that people may use to cope. However, as you asked, you know, it can also be a hindrance for getting the assistance that is needed, right? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, again, not enough research has been done to determine whether this masking behavior, right, is it a protective technique or is it a harmful technique? Mm-hmm. Because whatever it is, it's apparent that with this, a lot of missed and wrong diagnosis will happen, you know, when we talk about women in autism, right? On top of which, research has also shown that this whole masking behavior, it is, I mean, imagine you're pretending every day is kind of like a show. You know, mm-hmm. it can be exhausting, right? You can't be yourself. You're observing, you're pretending, you're trying your very best. So it has been linked to stress and anxiety. And women have also said that it's like they're losing their own sense of identity. You know, who am I really? I'm pretending to be somebody else. And so it's difficult, right? And you ask for some examples, right? So I mentioned the social motivation with women and girls are higher as compared to boys and men, right? So they understand that the importance to blend in, and they do it quite well. So some of the examples would be, forcing themselves to make eye contact, you know, during a conversation, or laughing along with a joke that they might not even understand, right? Or if you know you're going for a party, preparing some topics of conversation or preparing a joke before, right? Mm. You know, so can you imagine, like, even talking about it is like, wow, it's, how do you do this on a daily basis?
That's right.
Right? So it's difficult. So with little girls, you know, you can imagine the demands are not that high. But as they grow up, it gets a lot more difficult. The demands are a lot higher, and it's difficult. Yeah, it's very hard. Mm-hmm. And it's just this mimicking and learning socially acceptable behavior. And it's something that I suppose for neurotypical people, it's not something that is taught. It just comes naturally, right? So mm-hmm. it's something that is very challenging. And I'd like to, like, quote something that I read in an article. And I find that it makes it easy for us to understand. You know, she's a woman with autism who stated that how difficult it is for her on a day-to-day basis. You know, she said she understands the difficulty of she understands the importance of socializing, but it's so difficult for her, and she doesn't know what to do, and everything she does is by observing. And she described herself, it's like, she said it's like a duck on water. You know, on the surface, it's so calm and it looks so relaxed, but underneath, she's paddling really hard and trying her best to stay afloat. And that's how she described it. And I think that's quite a good summation of how difficult it might be for somebody trying really hard in a social setting.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, difficulty or challenges understanding social rules is, of course, a big challenge that they're grappling with. Now, when it comes to navigating social interactions, one of the things is also knowing where the dangers are, where people may not be what they seem, where what people say may not be actually what they will do, right? So there is a study which shared that women with late diagnosed autism were at higher risk of being sexually harassed. So could you share some insights on why this might be the case?
Okay, so linking it to what I said earlier as well, you know, how they are imitating people. Right. I mean, they're learning from they're picking up cues, or they're observing. Right. So, I mean, it's very possible that let's say a teenager, a young woman, an adult woman who has a guy flirt with her. Right. She might mimic that behavior without realizing that she's sending out certain signs, you know, and she might not realize that I can say no. So these are all little things that, again, with a neurotypical teenage girl or a young woman, we would teach as well. But imagine with a person who has challenges in this area, a lot more guidance is needed. Mm-hmm. You know, so much more guidance is needed, because reading other people's intentions is very difficult. And what more for a person of the opposite sex? You know, mm-hmm. is this person just being friendly, or is this person asking for more? Mm-hmm. You know, so you talked about sexual harassment, bullying as well. You know, workplace bullying, school bullying. This is all very common.
And our gender norms don't make it any easier, right? Women are conditioned to accept a lot of things that are done to them.
Yep, and there seems to be a different standard for women. You know, mm-hmm. women, the rules that are put upon women seem to be a bit more different, like social, we are meant to be, our social etiquette is meant to be better. It's okay for boys to be boisterous and loud or whatever not. Whereas mm-hmm. for girls, it's not. You know, we should be able to multitask. We should be able to look out for another person's needs. And if we don't, oh, something's not right. Mm-hmm. Right? So these roles are there, like you said, mm-hmm. you know.
On average, at what point would you say the girls and women that you see on the spectrum, at what point are they finally getting the right diagnosis?
Well, okay, to answer that question, again, it depends largely on how severe their difficulties are. Mm. You know how I mentioned how boys get diagnosed a bit quicker, earlier, right? And that's also because of the way their symptoms are presenting, right? So with girls, those with more obvious difficulties, right? Behavioral challenges, say intellectual difficulties, more repetitive behaviors and stuff, they get picked up quite early on because it reflects what we think autism looks like, you know, what we assume autism is like. So their presentation might be very typical,
yeah.
Right? However, with girls whose challenges are milder, you know, imagine a child who has friends, but very limited. If a few friends don't come to school or are not in college today, she just prefers to be by herself. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have strictly repetitive behaviors, but she likes to organize things and arrange things, you know. She has a strong imagination, you know, she's not to say she's totally black and white, you know, and concrete, and she has interest in certain areas. So the difficulties would be very, the symptoms might be very hard to identify, mm-hmm. right? So with people like this, much later, you know, I've seen girls who are 12, 15, and there have been lots of research that has been shown where women who are much older, you know, when they go to university, and how are these picked up? You know, so sometimes they themselves, you know, because they're trying to figure out what is going on.
Yeah.
You know, I've always, why don't I fit in like everybody else? I mean, can you imagine having this internal conflict, thinking that there's something not right, but I don't know what it is. Am I just weird? Mm-hmm. You know, I've had people say that to me, you know, yeah. And then it's a relief when they find out, like, oh my goodness, all right.
So, you know? So there is value for even an adult woman to try and pursue a diagnosis?
Yeah. I mean, because it gives you some closure. It gives you some clarity. And in terms of moving forward, it's like, it's not that this diagnosis will now define you, mm-hmm. but it becomes part of your identity. You know, it makes sense. It kind of completes you, yeah. if that makes any sense, right? And I've also seen some, I mean, how do some adult women come to this point, right? I've seen families whereby they have their own families and they have brought their child to be assessed. And sometimes at that point is when they are picked up.
Right.
You know, some through, because, you know, when you're assessing a child, you talk about developmental history, you talk about family history. And sometimes then the mummy opens up and says, oh, you know, when I was a child, da 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 da. You know, and then it becomes like, okay. Yeah. So then she gets referred. And so there are various ways in which older woman or a person in their late teens or university student might get diagnosed as well.
Would pursuing a diagnosis be more challenging for an adult, though? Because I guess the perception is that you should just accept whatever, you know, personality you are, if that's the label that people put on it, right? Somehow it's easier, I think, to try and investigate for a child rather than for an adult.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. With a child, it is easier to investigate, you know, while there might be some intricacies there, but with an adult, you use the right word. You know, people might just say, "It's what do you mean?" It's like you're trying to come up with the reason for why you're like this. You know, mm-hmm. it's just your personality. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just, you know, there'll be other labels. You're just rigid. You're just inflexible. You just want things your way.
Yeah.
You know, so those kind of terms come, but you can imagine how if a person has been her whole life, she's been told these kind of things when actually it's her difficulty. And that's why it's such an invisible illness, you know, especially when you're high functioning.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big struggle, right? And how you asked whether it's more tricky in adulthood. Yeah, because a lot of them actually may present to a psychiatrist or a psychologist or their physician with other illnesses like depression, yeah. or anxiety or OCD. You know, and all these things can be treated, but without knowing that there's this underlying factor, it makes it a lot more challenging, right? So I feel knowing this makes a huge difference, because then you would, your management plan, your treatment plan would be different.
What kind of interventions would be helpful if adult women are diagnosed with autism?
So, I mean, again, it would be therapy, you know, so like counselling, you know, trying to figure out areas in which that would be helpful for them. So coping strategies, mm-hmm. right? Coping with anxiety, stress management, then even typical things like day-to-day stuff, such as, you know, how would you manage your time management, you know, organizational skills, right? Mm-hmm. Things like physical appearance, perception, sexuality, grooming, you know, hygiene. So again, this is something like with teenage girls, this is a factor that a lot of parents are very nervous about, you know, puberty is coming, mm-hmm. right? How do we teach her about hygiene, self-care skills, right? Yeah. And then even as adults, peer pressure is still a factor. Right? Mm-hmm. Anger management, in this digital age now, social media management, how you put yourself out there, right? So all these things, and then transition into adult life. If we're talking about a person who is pretty independent, but mildly on the spectrum, let's say moving overseas for university, right? Mm-hmm. It's a very, very scary time for parents, you know, for families, like, is my child going to be okay?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So, you know, we started earlier talking about how research is biased towards male characteristics or how autism presents in men or boys. And therefore, that affects the way autism is diagnosed, the criteria that's used. So, you know, if we come full circle, do you have hope that research is moving fast enough and that we can update diagnostic criteria sooner rather than later to help more girls?
Yeah, I mean, again, all these things take a lot of time, right? Even to get to where we are took a lot of time, right? Mm-hmm. But moving forward, there's a lot more awareness now, and there is a lot more studies being done focusing on women and girls and to identify what the differences might be and how it manifests differently. I mean, it might even come to a time, I mean, like, you know, now when we talk about when a child goes to a pediatrician and their growth charts, right? Yeah. So for boys and girls, they're different growth charts,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Boys are known to, you know, their physical stature is different, right, compared to a girl. So I wonder whether in the future, even for when we talk about things like autism, might there be different thing? I mean, could there be a totally different guideline for a girl versus a boy?
Mm.
You know, so that might be something that would be useful in the future if research supports that.
Right. So if a doctor is or a physician is seeing a girl, use these guidelines or these criteria instead, right?
Yeah. And again, you know, like when we talk about seeing girls, the autism glasses that we have on, you know, the perception that we have about what it should look like, you know, tick in our head, we need to loosen that a little bit, because a girl that you might see might be just... like, you know, hiding in plain sight.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
And it's about what they are struggling with rather than what we think their behavior should be like.
Yes. Or what they are showing us on the surface.
Mm.
You know, like I remember that duck paddling example, right? So
right.
Lots of girls might be just floating through, you know, but then there might be certain instances where they just break down.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another thing that a lot of studies have shown as well. You know, a lot of families, a lot of adult women, they try and keep it together when they're at work because they know what the social rules are and they know what is expected of them. So even girls in school and women at work, you know, they put on the show when they're outside. But when they get back home to their families, they just let go. And so sometimes there's meltdowns at home. There's a lot of, you know, emotional letting go, because it's like, okay, now I can be myself.
Right.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine how difficult it must be, you know, how much courage it must take to say, I want to find out more about myself, because like we talked about earlier, especially if it presents as challenges at work, people are just going to say, Well, you know, you just don't want to do work, you know, you're lazy, or, you know, your behavior is like this. Don't try and excuse it by finding a clinical diagnosis, right? I mean, that must be one of the perceptions that people have.
Yep, definitely. And that's why the awareness and understanding is vital. Mm-hmm. You know, what more we're talking about, even health professionals finding it difficult to missing, you know, girls, mm-hmm. right, and women. So what about the larger community? You know, when how would they pick up on this? How would they understand, right? Mm-hmm. So, and also a very important thing is that getting women and girls to advocate for themselves, you know, but for them to be able to do that, they need to understand what's going on with them, mm. right? So again, like, you know, they're not defined by their diagnosis, but it's a part of them and they need to be able to speak up for themselves, right?
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Dania. I think on that note, I think we've really been able to explore how autism can be very different from girls and women and why it's so important to take a closer look looking at the disorder and how it presents differently and to understand more about the gender bias. I've been speaking to consultant clinical psychologist Dr. Dania Pile about the gender bias in autism. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.